Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey, everybody. This is Jonathan Watkins, one of the co-hosts of this episode of the Sincast. I just wanted to give you all a heads up that we had to record this in a little bit of a different format than we normally do. It was kind of a last-minute audible, if you will, and there ended up being a few technical difficulties or some audio hiccups, specifically with Chris's audio track, and there is a bit of a delay that occasionally you can hear. We did edit around it as best we could, but some of it still stands. I think you'll still really enjoy the interview. The good thing is Ivan sounds amazing, the director that we're interviewing of the new movie Son, which I highly, highly recommend you check out. And that movie will be available on March 5th. And so without further ado, here is the interview. Enjoy.
I'd find victims for her if I loved her, you know?
Yeah,
I'd lure
exactly.
People back.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins from CinemaSins.
Hello, hello.
And today we have a very special guest. It is writer-director Ivan Kavanagh, who has written and directed a movie called Son that is coming out in theaters, on demand, and digital March 5th. Welcome, Ivan.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here.
Yeah, you said you were in you're in Sweden currently?
Yeah. My wife is Swedish. And we have a place here. So we spent part of the time in Sweden and part of the time in Ireland. But I think this might be the first year where we spent almost a full year here. So I'm testing it out because we have a 5-year-old now and he's nearing school age. So we have to choose. We can't keep moving back and forth, you know?
That's fun.
So yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm missing Ireland already, you know? I'm one of these people who never in their entire life listened to Irish traditional music. And ever since I got here, I've been listening to Irish traditional music all the time. So I think that's a sign. I need to go home quick.
Tell us what the movie Son is about, and what was your inspiration for the story?
It's about a young mother played by Andy Matichek who lives alone with her son, and one night, she may or may not be visited by a cult that she escaped from 7 years previous. And after they leave, her son falls ill, and she thinks the cult did it to him. They instigated it. Then she goes on this journey on the run to get away from them, and she has to do unspeakable things to make her son survive. The beginning of it was really is a really personal. I usually start from a really personal place with all my films, and this one was no different. It was actually after the birth of my son 5.5 years ago, my first son, and he had a really difficult birth, and we were really really worried about him for months after, you know, and we had a lot of sleepless nights. And but during this time, I saw how close him and his mother, my wife, were becoming, you know, and you know that mother son bond is so. I don't know, something primal about it. It's much stronger than the child-father bond, I think. And I began to think, you know, a mother who truly loves her son more than anything else in the world, is there anything she wouldn't do for him? How far would she go for him, you know? And that was the starting point. That was the genesis of it. You know, so in between feeding the baby and the baby crying and no sleep, that's when I began to jot down all these ideas about son. So that was the starting point.
I was just going to say, that's the thing, because, you know, as a parent myself, I mean, and I think non-parents can think about what it would be like for them. But I think as a parent myself, like when I watch these movies that deal more with parental horror now, I'm always thinking, like putting myself in that position and like, you know, like what if my daughter was like a vampire or got turned into a vampire or something? Like, it's like, it's like, that would be terrible, but I would, but she would still be my daughter and I'd still have to like figure out a way, right? To, you know,
I mean, it's just crazy. I would, I'd find victims for her if I loved her, you know,
yeah,
I'd lure people back. You know? This is my daughter. You don't mind if she sits on your lap for a second, do you? You know, definitely would. Of course you would. You do anything to protect your child.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I was wondering what sort of went into creating the character of Laura, because she's got this, you know, horrific backstory. I mean, she is obviously has fled a cult of some sort, and she's and she has a memory of her father raping her and everything. Yeah. So what was it that you, what did you go, what, how did you create her character?
Well, I wanted to, you know, wrong foot the audience. I wanted the audience to feel like, well, first of all, they had to like Laura. They had to, and that was the cast, that was crucial with casting. You know, it has to be an actress who was instantly likable and not only could pull off the role and was talented enough to pull off the role, but had to be instantly likable. And the moment I met Andy Matichek, I knew this had to be Laura, because she's so charismatic, so instantly likable. I mean, she's one of these people on the set that everyone loves, you know, and she's so intelligent. So I knew that no matter what Laura does all the way through the film, the audience would always stay with her, you know. But I also wanted the audience to be unsure whether this person they were following was insane or sane, you know, and whether what version of reality was real, you know. So I purposely structured the film so in one scene we see what she sees, which is stuff about the demon and the cult. But in the next scene, someone else says, no, in fact, that didn't happen at all. It's all in her head. And then the following scenes after that, we see her back in her head and so on and so forth. So the audience is never quite sure where they are with her until the very end, you know? And the stuff about the cult, again, the cult came out of, you know, all of these conspiracy theories you read online about cults running the world and, you know, pedophile cults and all this sort of stuff. And I wanted to weave that into it to add to the doubt about Laura's sanity, you know, whether it was real or not, you know. And I thought it was very, very important to have to ground it in real evil as well as that fantastic evil, you know, the evil that the demon is, you know. Because for me, the demon just represents the evil of people, you know, because if this cult weren't worshiping the demon, they'd find other excuses to do the terrible things that they do, you know? So, yeah, I mean, that's the reason I wove all of that cult and the folk horror type stuff into it.
Yeah. I was wondering if you had done any research at all on these types of cults, or did you just, you know, kind of give a bare bones idea of what a cult is and just write it into your movie?
I mean, I've always been fascinated by cults, and I've read many books, you know, about Jonestown and all those sort of stuff. And I think we all know deep down what these, you know, and we've all heard the rumors of what they do and what they could do. And when we were in Mississippi, I remember we shot the film in Mississippi, and when we were there, we went to several of these houses, location scouting, especially in the poorer neighborhoods. And they were talking all of these rumors, maybe they were urban myths, I don't know, about these people coming into people's homes and abducting them into you know, slavery. And it was really strange. Like when we mentioned the film was about a cult, everyone had their own cult story or cult or urban myth. So, I mean, that's why Mississippi was perfect for that. It was just, it's so soaked in that sort of, that gothic sort of, you know, and so crumbling. It's an amazing place, Mississippi, and the people are amazing there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you where you shot this, because I wasn't quite sure where it was. What were the areas of Mississippi?
We shot in Cleveland, Mississippi, and in Greenville and Clarksdale, and Greenwood as well. I mean, I went for about a month and a half before we shot scouting locations, just me and the location scout. And for me, coming from Ireland, everything looks so cinematic. Everything looks so exotic, you know, because growing up on an American movies, I felt like I was seeing things that the location scout was just passing by. I was saying, look at that motel, you know, stop. And he was saying, well, it's just a motel. No, but it looked so cinematic to me, you know. And it's an amazing place.
Yeah.
That is fascinating because we would have the opposite, right? If we went from, because we're in the South, I mean, we're not far from Mississippi. And so the idea of somebody finding Mississippi cinematic is kind of funny to me. But but if I went to Ireland, I'd be like saying the same thing about Ireland, probably.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that's the way, maybe the film has a different take on America. I think maybe I had a different eye for what Americans who were there every day or people living in Mississippi would normally see, you know. But where in the world would I have found a motel like that motel with that crazy factory behind it, you know? What a place to put a motel.
No, now that you say Mississippi, I'm like, that was definitely a Mississippi motel. You're right. Absolutely.
100%. It's so unbelievable. It was just, when we turned the corner, we found that place at night. It was like someone had built a motel in hell or something. It was just, you could hear all these amazing factory sounds and the steam shooting into the back near the rooms where the rooms were. And it was just insane. The moment I saw that, I said, this is it. This is the Pibb Motel. You know, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The decay of the buildings in Mississippi, everything seems to be crumbling there as well, you know, and the swamps. It's just an amazing place.
You discussed Andy Matichak, but I definitely want to hear about your casting for this and how you got her and then how Emil Hirsch got on and how you, scouted for, child actors and to get into this movie.
Well, Emil came on first, as far as I know. Maybe it was Andy. I can't remember, but I had seen, of course, seen the first Halloween movie that she did. Mm-hmm. And I really liked her in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't traditionally audition. I just like to meet the actor and see what they're like. And as I said, the moment I met her, I knew it had to be her, you know. And I just called the producer straight away and I said, perfect, let's go, you know. Emil, I had done a previous film with. We did a Western together called Never Grow Old. And at the end of that movie, we had liked working together so well that he said, listen, if you have anything else, you know, giving me a shout, I'd love to work with you again. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I have the script. So I gave him the script and he loved the part of the detective because he had never played a part like that before, you know. And Emil just relished he relished it because it was like the cop seems, I don't want to give anything away, but the cop seems to be this, like a cop who's out of his depth, you know. He's too nice for his job. He seems to care too much about the people he's investigating, you know. And Emil just had, he felt like he was the puppet master or something. He was just, he just loved it, you know? Well, the thing about the kid was I knew we had to find the right kid or else the film wouldn't work, you know? And we auditioned about 500 kids, mostly from New York and LA. Some of them were great, but I didn't find the one, you know? And the producers were getting really worried and putting pressure on me because we'd only like 2 or 3 weeks away from shooting. And then I asked the casting directors to try locally instead. So try around Mississippi and all that area and Tennessee and all of this, you know. And then this self-tape came in from Atlanta, where Luke is from, who played David. And he was just so natural on camera compared to all the other kids. Yeah, a lot of the other kids seemed to be like movie kids, you know. They were quite good, but you know they were acting, you know, or just saying lines. But Luke was just so natural. So the next day I drove down to Atlanta to meet him and his father. And I did some improv with him and just chatted to him. And I was just absolutely amazed because there was no difference on and off camera with Luke. He could be completely natural on camera, which is really hard, you know, especially for a child, you know, to not give a performance, especially when saying lines, you know. And then added to that, I had a great ally in Luke's father, Matthew, because Matthew is an actor himself. So he understands the process. Mm-hmm. He understands what you had to do to prepare for a part, you know. So I was able to say to Matthew, Luke's father, you, but not Luke, should watch, say, Ingmar Bergman's film, Cries and Whispers, and watch how the woman in that is writhing in pain, how she reacts to pain. That's what I want from Luke, that kind of a performance, you know, that intense and those kind of that kind of physicality. So he was able to go watch the film and then convey to Luke as a father how to do that, you know. So that by the time we got to rehearsal and to the set, all I had to do was tweak the performance and push it in more of the direction I wanted. But Luke was just incredible. I mean, he could take direction better than most adults, you know, and his role is so difficult. I mean, most adults would find it challenging, you know, but he loved every minute of it, especially the gore stuff. He just loved that. It was a great game to him.
I always wonder how kids react to stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I had done another film. Actually, the last two films I did, The Canal was another horror movie I did. Mm-hmm. And then Never Grow Old after that.
So I've seen that one.
Yeah, I had done a lot of experience with working with kids, you know. And with kids, you just need to keep it like a game, you know. You need to keep the mood up all the time. And with horror stuff, you just need to expose them to the mechanics of the filmmaking. Mm-hmm. So I made sure Luke knew how the blood was made. I showed Luke, me and the MFX guy were able to show him how we mixed the blood, what it was made out of, how we got the dark color that I wanted. We were able to show him the prosthetic arms and that kind of stuff. And he just loved it. It was like a big game to him, you know. And then anything too scary, we just take him out of the room after we shot his side of it and then do the rest of it, you know. But it's like a game, and they never really know they're in a horror movie. It's just great fun. But Luke was taking selfies with his father, covered in blood and stuff. He thought it was amazing. Yeah.
That's the thing. When you hear the stories about The Shining and how Danny didn't know he was in a horror movie and everything. Yeah. And it's like, how do you guys do that?
It's really easy to do.
Yeah. You mentioned the canal, and you had a wonderful child actor in there too, who really very much seemed like a 5-year-old kid all the way through.
Yeah. 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 Well, that's what I like. I mean, as I said, I hate that those movie kid type actors, you know, you just don't buy it, you know. Mm-hmm. And especially with the more fantastical the film, the more crazy the film, I think you need to ground it in the real reality, you know. You need those very naturalistic performances for it to work. I mean, just look at the The Exorcist, maybe, which is really grounded, mm-hmm. very naturalistic performances. But what's going on is insane. But you believe what's going on because of how natural all the actors are, and because he's grounded in real reality. So that was a good lesson I learned from that.
Another person that stood out to me in this is Cranston Johnson, who plays Emil Hirsch's partner. I think he may actually be the only person actually grounded in reality for most of this. Grounded in reality.
Is the only truly good person in the entire film? Is the only person who's truthful? I think. Even though even Andy's character doesn't know whether what is real or what it isn't, you know, and she has to do some terrible things, but Cranston's character is completely is the good person in it. You know, he's the only innocent in the entire film. You know, and Cranston was great. He was great to work with.
Yeah, he got a little bit of gallows humor in this movie too. He seems so cold, but at the same time, it's very darkly funny at the same time.
And his delivery is great when the body is on the ground. He says, "You think she's dead?" And
so well done.
Because there's so many scenes in this where I was breaking up laughing. There's so much black humor in this. I think many people, when they watch it, from what I've heard, it is shocking, I suppose, you know, and it is dread-filled and all those things. But there is moments of humor as well, I thought, as I was making it, you know, especially, you know, with Cranston's character. And, you know, there's a line that it always makes me laugh it makes the audience laugh with the audience I've seen when the kid says, I won't say what he's doing, but he says, "Mom, I feel much better now." And
yes.
That was Luke's favorite day, you know.
Yeah,
actually, at the very end of the shoot, I said to Luke, he was going off to catch a plane with his father, and I said to him and his father, "What was your favorite day? What's the best scene that you did?" And he says, "Killing the pimp." And
that's a really well done scene. I loved it.
It's not every day you hear a kid saying that, you know. Great.
No, that's true. For sure. do you have any kind of sort of philosophy about making a scary scene at all? Like, do you have a, do you have an idea in your head what it's going to look like when it's edited, or do you find it there on set, or is it just a combination of things? Do you have a way that you do things like that?
No, well, when we go in, I know every shot in the film before it begins, you know, so there is no, there is no alternate angles for any of the scenes. So what you see is exactly what will be shot. Every shot that we shot is in the film. So basically all that has to be done is to be spliced together in the edit. So say, for example, that very long drawn out scene where she's going into the bathroom with the pimp. I mean, that's basically, we shot that in sequence. So I was able to say, we need a tracking shot here, her point of view. We need a tracking shot moving back. So it was completely planned, you know. And when, at the very beginning of a film, I sit down with the DP, Pierce McGrail, and I'm able to say to him, this scene consists of a wide shot and a close-up. And we perfect it on the day when we get there. But we know when we go into each one that each scene, what each scene consists of. So we know every shot before we begin, you know. So it's very much in the, say, the Hitchcock on the Palma method where or of making films where it's pre-planned, you know. There is no alternate takes, there is no coverage other than what you see, you know. And the same with the sound design as well. I mean, when I'm writing, I which sound design is a huge part for building scares and atmosphere, especially. I mean, when I'm writing, I already hear the sound design in my head, you know. So what I do then at the end of the film, when we when I have a locked picture, I go in with the sound designer, Asa Hand, who I've worked with for the past three films, and I'm able to dictate to him, like as if it's a music score, the sound design. And then he always brings more to it and makes it better than I imagined even. But yeah, it's all pre-planned in my head. So when I'm writing it, it's already there and I'm already seeing it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I wondered that because I guess everybody's different, but that sounds like you really know what you want before you go in, and maybe you have to. Maybe it's a type of thing where it's you know, you don't want to waste too much time or money or anything like that, and you've got it all set. So
It's that, and it's holding onto control of it as well. You know, because if you know what every shot is, and there is no alternate way to edit things as well. So I'm making like a guarantee that the film is totally mine, you know, every shot in it. So if I shoot multiple angles, then it can be edited in multiple ways, but there's very limited ways my films can be edited other than what we shot.
Interesting. Can you tell us what might have been your most difficult day on set?
Oh, it was so many. I felt like the film was cursed, actually. It was the hardest. I mean, before that, I made a Western in the worst muddy conditions imaginable. I shot the Western in the west of Ireland and in Luxembourg, and we got the coldest winter on record and mud up to our knees. And it was absolutely horrendous, but nothing compared with the ordeals of this, you know. it might have been just that I was aware of the type of film we were making, and I'm superstitious, but I found that these real demon incantations for conjuring demons. It's these Babylonian ones, and I kind of made my own version of them. And I have an archaeologist friend who was able to show me all of these translations of all these incantations, the Babylonian ones, and then used bits of an Egyptian one as well. And anyway, I made up my own, and it was an incantation to rise the demon. And I remember I said it aloud to myself in the hotel one night, you know, before we shot this was when we were in pre-production. And the next day I went down to my desk in the production office, and my desk, and only my desk, was covered in thousands of ants. Like, it was just unbelievable. Wow. It was like something straight out of a horror movie. There was ants crawling all over my desk, you know, in my office, and nobody else's office or was touched in any way, you know. And then during production, we were hit by two tornadoes. Yeah, really weird. And then we were hit by two tornadoes. the first tornado, location scouting, suddenly we were parked at this crossroads in Mississippi, and it was about dusk. And suddenly the whole car fogged up in an instant, you know? And we rolled down the window. There was like this hot air outside. And I saw the, what do you call it? The funnel descending in the distance. Mm-hmm. It was coming down. And then all the sirens went off. And we had to take shelter in this woman's house. We just randomly knocked on. It was absolutely terrifying. And then another night, a hurricane ripped through the whole of Mississippi. Or no, a tornado ripped through the whole of Mississippi. And we were supposed to shoot at Mrs. Nagel's house, which is supposed to be this rural Kansas house, the next day. And I got a call from the very distraught production designer saying, I have bad news for you, Ivan. Do you know that house we were meant to shoot in today? Well, the tornado ripped the tree out of the ground and it went right through the roof into our set. And I couldn't believe it. It was like, so we drove down about 7 a.m. or 6 a.m. or whatever it was, because we were supposed to shoot at 9. And there was literally a house in the front, or a tree in the front room going, and you can see it in the film. But I thought it was amazing. I said, let's just use it. Let's just go with it. So we cleared out the living room, and for the exterior, you can see the tree on top of the car and on top of the house. But things like that, you know, although I felt like we were cursed, they were kind of blessings in disguise at the same time, you know. And then loads of times we had to shut down because lightning was too close, and we had a few organizational disasters with vehicles and stuff. It was just, we felt like it was bad luck, and it was a really tough shoot, but we got everything we needed, every shot I wanted, so I didn't compromise at all. So we got through it in the end, but boy, was it tough.
I imagine so. So yeah, you didn't have one particular day. It was like nearly all the days that was...
Nearly all the days. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Jonathan, do you have any more?
Well, I was going to say on top of that, and if you've said this, I apologize, but what was the time frame on this? Like, how many days was the shoot? I'm assuming it was pretty short, right?
Yeah, it was really short. I think it was 4.5 weeks or almost 5 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
So it was really tough, and especially for a film with so many locations that we had. I mean, we were zipping around Mississippi, you know, sometimes three different locations a day. And then we did it in the middle of winter, and it was, you know, it was really muddy conditions. And of course those tornadoes didn't help. And yeah, it was really tough to schedule, you know. It felt like some days I didn't have enough time, but again, I knew all the shots, so that made it much easier. I don't think if I had went in with a method maybe other directors use where they find it on the day, well, there's no way we would have made the schedule, you know? And especially with a film with so many MFX and practical effects, which take a lot of time, you know, and a lot of tracking shots, a lot of really complicated lighting setups as well. And now, I mean, I'm glad I do all the shots. Otherwise, we would never have made that crazy schedule, you know?
Well, this is the type of movie that we don't want to spoil, although I would love to get into some of the later parts of this movie.
Especially the end. My God, people. The end.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. The end, for sure. But we don't want to spoil it too much. I sort of want to ask more, but I don't know what else to ask without getting into spoiler territory.
Yeah.
I will say it's one of those interesting things though, where I think the twist is really good, but at the same time, I think the movie would actually work without it, which is really interesting to me when that happens. But I love that it's there. I absolutely love that it's there. I'm not knocking it. That's great.
Yeah. I think a lot of people for the lead up to it, especially, you know, there's one character involved with the twist and people all the way through the film, I kind of like from what I've heard from people talking about it, they said, well, I was on the fence about the character. I thought, or that person is in on it, or they're not in on it, or they are in on it. And by the end came, they said, oh, he's not in on it. And then suddenly he is, you know? So, but then again, I always thought it was as a dream movie, you know? It feels like a dream to me as I'm watching it, like a night, has the logic of a nightmare, the film, you know? And I always thought of the end as possibly being Laura's final nightmare. You know, it's nothing is true 100%. You know, I think even at the end, there's some ambiguity, or I hope there is. You know, I don't think it's final for me. It wasn't, but others can if they want to find a complete answer in it. But I don't think it's even final about the nature of the boy either, because he is half of his mother after all. You know, so. we don't know what's going to happen next. It's funny, at the end of the shoot, the producer said to me, you're going to have to think of a sequel now. And I said, I'm not going through this again, ever. This was the worst experience I ever had. But funny, the other day, I thought of this amazing sequel idea. So, I don't know. It depends on how well it's received. It depends on how well it's received and it does. But I had this crazy idea, and I think I've never seen anything quite like it.
If you're going to make a horror sequel, crazy is always the way to go. Just FYI.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Never say never on the sequels.
Yeah.
So yeah, if hopefully this does well then, because I would like to see the sequel to this for sure.
It's insane, the sequel. So
the sun takes Manhattan.
You think that? Yeah, exactly. Do you think that if you weren't going to make a sequel to this, that the movie that you wrote would be good on its own?
First one, you mean this one?
If this first one you feel like didn't get received well, and you didn't want to do the sequel or whatever, do you think the sequel that you wrote would make a good movie on its own?
No, it has to be. It's a direct continuation, or pretty much, you know. It's what happened. Yeah. It's literally what happens next, you know.
You're teasing us. You got to make it now. Yeah, right. Has to happen. Sorry.
I know.
Figure it out.
I saw it. I think the key to it is in the sequel. I'm just teasing it now. But the sequel idea is, do you remember that dream that the boy recounts to his mother about floating in the sky and the world cracking in half, but him being untouched and not afraid? Well, that was the key to the sequel. And that's
okay.
Cool.
So anyway, it might never happen, but it's good to dream.
We'd like to thank writer director Ivan Kavanaugh for giving us some of his time. The movie is Sun. It comes out in theaters on demand and digital March 5th. Thank you so much for joining us, Ivan.
Yeah, thanks a million, guys.
Yeah, that's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkins and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/cinemasins.